Welcome to the Fuller Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy, recording at 2:17 p.m. and that is Central Time. And today being Friday, it's the big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. And today is June 18th, and there's a lot of conflicting signals that are coming through, and it's a difficult market environment, and there are a lot of competing narratives about exactly how to make sense of everything that's going on. So I'm going to try to cut through some of the difficulty here, because it was looking like, for example, the dollar was going to break lower, and it has rebounded. And then it was also looking likely that value was going to outperform growth, and we've had a reversal there as well. So one way to think about it is that this is a market where we're getting short trends, and we need to be nimble, and there's a lot of movement between sectors, so that you get very short, sharp moves, and then it requires a lot of nimbleness and willingness to adapt to the environment, to jump between sectors in order to sustain outperformance and relative strength in a portfolio. And then, of course, there are the bigger themes. And these are, I think, also interesting times in terms of what exactly is going on in terms of monetary policy, and what is likely over the medium term. And I thought we'd kick off this week and look at the difference between the 10-year and the 3-month treasury bills. So it's the somewhat longer version, or wider maturity version, of the yield curve spread. Historically, it's been incredibly cyclical, but the ebb and flow, or the peak to trough swings, can happen quickly or they can happen slowly. And I wonder whether we're at a similar situation today to what we saw in the mid-1990s, or potentially we're at a situation today similar to what we saw between 1989 and 1992, or between 2000 and 2002, or between 2007 and 2008 or 9. So one thing is, I think, clear, that when we get the trough to peak swing in these in this relationship between the short end and the long end of the curve, well, more often than not, it happens rather quickly. And when it does not happen quickly, then, and most particularly when that bounce from the lower side of the range to the upper side of the range fails and loses consistency, well, then we're in for a period where it can bounce around for a while and then subsequently move to a new low. So we can think about the kinds of moves we've had on the upside, and these very V-shaped reversals in some cycles. And then we can also think about the longer duration moves that take years to unfold. And what I think is most relevant here is that the spread peaked in 92 and then didn't bottom again until 2000. And for the last 4 years, it just did a lot of ranging. And there were a number of very important macro events that occurred during that time, like the Russian debt default and the peso crisis and the Asian financial crisis. And of course, then long-term capital management went bust as a result of the Russian debt default. And it required interest rates to stay lower for longer and a lot of liquidity to get pumped into the market. And that helped to fuel a bubble in the TMT sector. And then you had the additional complication of Y2K, which pulled forward earnings from years in the future into 1998 and 1999, where then we just had this incredible fervor for everything new. And we had spectacular bull markets in everything relating to technology, telecoms, media, and biotech. And then interest rates were risen because of that irrational exuberance and speculative activity, and the investment boom popped. And usually, it's when the yield curve spread is rising from an inverted condition that this is usually representative of central banks being tightening beyond the realm where it was reasonable, so that they are the people that create recessions, and then having to become aggressive in hitting the accelerator on money supply and in cutting interest rates. So then you get this very wide spread between the long and the short ends of the curve, and it becomes stimulative and it sets up the conditions for the next bull market. We saw exactly the same thing in the aftermath of the credit crisis, and this contraction is in fact longer than the contraction that we saw from the peak in 1992. So it peaked around 2009, and we had a bottom in 2019. So it was a full decade of contraction. Now, the question, of course, is this a normal cycle? And this, I think, is where a lot of the difficulty with analyzing markets right now comes in. Because we've had so many different extraordinary measures introduced. Central banks are not supposed to be able to buy corporate bonds. They did it anyway. The ECB has really only got one mandate, which is to control inflation. And they have expanded into all manner of different different activities, whether that is regulating the banking sector or creating pan-European bonds. So these are extraordinary measures. And then, of course, we've had this huge rise in money supply. So that money supply has jumped by 30 or 40% in the last year. And that money has helped to create significant bull markets. So when we think about what would be normal, well, it would be normal after an inversion, and a significant inversion like we had in 2019, that the spread would go all the way back up to the peak. So that would be 400 basis points in a difference between the long and the short end of the curve. At a minimum, it would require interest rates on the short end to be zero and the long end to be 4%. But we're just not seeing that. So that yield curve spread is now starting to come back down. It broke down from this little range, encountered resistance this week in the region of the lower side of it, and then popped back down on in here today. Now, if we look at the 30-year Treasury yield, well, it doesn't look like it's going to start rising anytime soon. This was a 2 consecutive weeks on the downside in a dynamic manner. So the 30-year has now completely unwound its overextension relative to the trend mean. So what this is beginning to price in is the potential that growth is not going to surprise on the upside. And because of the extraordinary measures that we've seen introduced, where we've had just this incredibly impressive advance over the course of the last year, then the compression in yields and the weakness in stock markets. So what we're definitely seeing here today is that both bonds and that there's compression in the bond markets, or in the bond yields, which is creating demand for safe havens like treasuries. And then we're seeing weakness in the stock market, and we're seeing strength in the dollar. So there is demand for safe havens. and the dollar has been up in a dynamic manner on three consecutive days now. This is an impressive rebound, and it's similar in magnitude to what we saw in early March. And if the bearish dollar consensus is going to be proved correct, well, we're going to have to see a significant reversal and reasonably soon. Might be a little early yet to conclude that this is a significant low, but it's a big upward dynamic. And we would have to give the benefit of the doubt to the most recent dynamic. So that would suggest that there is at least near term and potentially now medium term support around the 90 area. And I do favor looking at the Bloomberg Dollar Index because it's got more currencies in it. And here also we have it trading back above the trend mean, rallying in a dynamic manner. So in order to demonstrate that we're still in a generally bearish environment for the dollar, it would have to start to fail in the next week or two and then pull back down into the lower side of the range and potentially break lower. As long as the dollar is strengthening, it represents a flight to quality and certainly a deleveraging process. And the raising of cash out of speculative actions. And then because of the fact that the dollar is a linchpin for foreign investors into emerging markets and into international markets, or at least US investors going abroad, then the strength of the dollar makes those other markets less attractive, and you get money siphoned out of them. And that's exactly what's happening with the European markets in here today, falling more than Wall Street. It's also, I think, worth just simply considering that the S&P 500 is overextended relative to the trend mean, and it could pull back by around 10% and still be in the region of the trend mean. So I think it's likely that we're going to see something like that, or at least it will come back into the region of the 4,000 area. The Federal Reserve has decided that they, or at least they signaled to the market that they believe that they're going to raise interest rates twice in the next, or by the end of 2023. And that was more hawkish than I was willing to give any credence to. I didn't think that they would get cold feet at the prospect of some inflationary pressures. If they truly believe that the inflationary pressures are transitory, then they wouldn't be under any duress to tighten policy. So perhaps the Fed is getting a little bit wary of the inflationary pressures that are rising. But the one thing that's clear is that the strength of the dollar puts a crimp on demand for commodities. And the LME Metals Index has pulled back in a violent manner in here this week. So this is the second big downward dynamic in the last 5 weeks. And now it's coming back towards the 4,000 area. It's so far a little bit larger in terms of the size of the pullback, and it's encountering resistance in the upper side of this 14-year range. So we may get some pause and consolidation. And of course, this also raises the question whether we've had a cyclical bull market or we've had a secular bull market. Or we're in the beginning of a secular bull market. And I think this is another one of the really big questions. So we get this secular versus cyclical argument at the beginning of all secular bull markets and at the end of cyclical bull markets. So it's an important question. And then we can also start to think about how much of the bull market that we've seen over the last year has been about liquidity, how much of it is about the emerging secular trends, and then how much of the bull market has been about the rotation into the sectors that will thrive in the post-pandemic era. Of course, there's then one other question, and it is, has the pandemic in fact ended? So one, I think we need to pay attention to the countries where the Delta variant is rising. And the pound was down in a dynamic manner in here today, and Boris Johnson has had to pull back on the ambition of completely opening up the economy, and the number of people turning up in hospital as a result of the pandemic has started to increase in the UK. So that's potentially going to also factor through into other countries because the Delta variant is spreading faster, and most particularly among unvaccinated populations. There's still a raging debate going on online about the efficacy of the vaccines, but the one thing that we can certainly say is that we have evidence now. So rather than giving full credence to the anti-vax community or to people that say vaccines are the only answer, we can look at evidence from places like Israel, where they vaccinated the whole country, and they do have some unexpected side effects, and they are relatively small in number, and they are so far benefiting from their vaccination program. Of course, there are hugely large swathes of the world that have yet to be vaccinated, and that was one of the primary reasons why India had such a hard time when this particular variant popped up there. So, on the one hand, we have the risk that the opening up of the global economy will be somewhat slower than was anticipated just 6 weeks ago. Then we have the potential that central banks are going to be less generous with the quantity of money that they're printing. So, when we add those two factors together, then there is clearly the potential for some mean reversion. And if we are now in a secular bull market for commodities, well, then the commodities will hold the majority of their recent run-up over the last year, and then will subsequently rebound in a dynamic manner. If we just simply look at the copper price, well, I think it's important to just look at it at what did it do during the last or the beginning of the last bull market. So it rallied really impressively in early 2003, and it went from around 70 and change up to about 140, so a clear doubling. And then it broke out to new highs, and if we can just simply zoom in on all of that action. And it had been ranging before that for about 16 years. And there was again this raging debate going on in 2003 and 4 about whether it was a secular or a cyclical bull market. And of course, at the time, the sheer size and demand outlook that China and its industrialization represented were underappreciated by many investors. So the copper price subsequently went up a lot more. And from that breakout, it more than doubled again. So now we're at the very similar condition that there are certainly people looking at this extraordinary advance, thinking perhaps that it looks rather like this move that we had in 2008 through to 2011, and thinking this is a reflation trade and we're in the region of the previous peak, and now we've had this much larger pullback and it's dipping down into that underlying range, and it would have triggered a midpoint danger line stop in here today. So that at least suggests that we have a peak of near-term significance. And potentially, if you're hewing or adhering to the cyclical bull market hypothesis, this is probably over. But then we can think about, well, what is the secular bull market hypothesis? And it's in, I think, in inextricably linked to carbon pricing. So I've posted quite a few different pieces of our statistics in here today with the ambition of trying to put a price on just how much additional costs do carbon taxes represent. Because the one thing that's missing in this bull market is a bull market, a secular bull market case for oil. It was easy to make a bull market case for oil back in 2003 and 2004. And when I joined David in late 2003, in fact, I joined on my birthday, my first day working with David was on my birthday in 2003. And right then, it was just the beginning of the commodity bull market. And we had this incredible advance over the next almost decade. And back in 2003 and 2004, when oil was just moving through this $40 area, well, there was this big debate about whether it was sustainable to for prices to hold these levels. And were we ever going to see a price above $40? That was something that just people couldn't really get their heads around. And of course, prices went to 140, and this was an oil-led bull market, and the increasing demand for oil and the increasing price of oil represented a significant headwind to the cost of production for just about everything else. So we had increasing demand for all manner of commodities, and then we had the higher oil price adding to the cost of production. So it created this massive swell of interest in the commodity complex. But we also had this massive swell of investment in the commodity complex. And the shale oil sector and unconventional supply generally have succeeded in bringing vast quantities of new product to the market. And that means today that there is about 8 million barrels a day of supply that is being held off the market by OPEC. And this is the exact opposite situation that we had back in 2003. Back then, there just wasn't any additional supply. There had been decades of significant absence of investment in new supply. So the industry was just incapable of increasing supply in a timely manner, so we had this phenomenal bull market. Well, right now, a lot of OPEC members are attempting to try and support prices so that they can survive, and they don't want to see the price ever drop below 40 again. But at the same time, as prices rise, they're going to become progressively more encouraged to let some of that supply that's held off the market back into the market, because they'll want to make money. And that's, I think, one of the inhibiting factors in the potential for oil prices to continue to rally. And instead, what we're seeing is that there is less investment in new supply, and investors are divesting of their fossil fuel positions, and the companies themselves are going to have increasing difficulty in either raising money for new supply or in going out to geopolitically sensitive areas of the world and investing in new supply. And I think it's reasonable to conclude that we're not going to have a new secular bull market in oil. And by that, I mean that it would get all the way back up to somewhere between 120 and 140 and then break out and then multiply. That would be a secular bull market in oil. I just don't believe we're going to get that until that excess of supply represented by the OPEC surfeit of supply is eventually eroded. Now, that can be eroded in a couple of different ways. It could be geopolitical tensions that just keep the oil off the market or destroy infrastructure. It could be that companies go bust and the supply gets locked in. We're seeing that kind of locking in of supply occurring in Brazil with the pre-salt, and then with the cancelling of the Keystone pipeline in Canada. That's just limiting the ability of Canada to export additional supply. So, can we have a bull market without oil being the driver of that bull market? That, I think, is the biggest question, and it's something that is going to be extremely important to attempt to answer. And I think that as we look at what's happening with the world and everything that's and the perceptions of how rapidly the world is warming and how much change is going on, well, carbon prices in Europe continue to trend higher. And they were in additional positive territory today and bouncing from the lower side of their range. And if we just simply look at how Germany has priced carbon, it's mandating that prices will increase on a increment on an incremental basis every year until 2026 and 2027, and then it'll go to outright pricing competition within set bands. So not only do they have the highest cost of electricity in the world right now among the developed countries, but that it's going to get more expensive. And what I find, I was really just surprised today to see that the additional costs that they're going to put on are almost the same as what I pay for electricity right now. And of course, that represents a significant cost, particularly on utilities. So, utilities are going to be forced to change how they generate electricity. And that's a process that's already well established. And automotive companies, they just simply cannot afford to fund their competitors. So, and that is exactly why a lot of the major automotive companies are now going full on for electric vehicles, because they were buying carbon credits from Tesla. So Tesla, by selling carbon credits, was funding the building of its own factories, which were then acting as competitors to the same companies that they were selling carbon credits to. And that kind of virtuous circle from Tesla's perspective represents the potential ruin of the other automotive companies. And what's been quite clear is that every time we've seen these companies adopting an electric mandate, they've been rewarded by investors. So Volkswagen surged higher in the first quarter, and now it is susceptible to some consolidation, and again in the region of the peak. And Ford has also been resurgent of late, and it's also now unwinding this really quite clear short-term overbought condition. What I found rather interesting today was looking at BYD as a major producer of electric vehicles in China, and it's had the pullback and now it is rebounding again. The other thing that I think rather relevant right now is that Tesla started underperforming when headlines started to shoot around the world that its market cap was greater than that of the entire automotive sector combined. And it has also endured its reversion to the mean, and it's at least holding this $600 area. What I found interesting today was we had a similar comparison being made of Hermès. So Hermès has been accelerating higher, and now it looks like it's due a consolidation. It could pull back by a quarter and still be reverting towards the mean. But the bigger picture here is that it was being bought for a number of reasons. One is that it's a limited supply kind of company. They deliberately hold back supply. And of course, then it was also being bought because it has pricing power. And it was being bought because it's a reflection of how much money has been printed. And it's got a price to sales ratio now of nearly 20. So that is really a very racy valuation. And it would suggest that a lot of good news has already been priced in. But the additional point is that if it is truly a representation of how much money has been printed, well, then this is a company that has got revenues and a real business, and it's certainly producing products that people want. Well, GameStop is a company with very few prospects and has got a business model that is heavily impaired. But as a result of the big pop on the upside, it now has a market cap of $15.5 billion, and that is much reduced from where it was at the peak. And then its price to sales isn't as aggressive as Hermes is, but the reality is that this looks like the kind of thing that could really pull back in a violent way. And if we're seeing more demand for cash because the dollar is rallying, well, then that's also weighing on other speculative activities. So Bitcoin was down by $2,300 in here today. And I've been quite clear in highlighting that this looked like a market peak and that it doesn't have any real evidence yet that the bear market is over. And the one thing that that really stands out to me, at least, is the tendency of the of Bitcoin to find support in the region of the 1,000-day or 200-week moving average following big bull markets. Well, that would suggest that the relevant point of potential support is going to be somewhere around $13,000. And that's a long way from where prices are right now. Now, the big challenge in terms of the stock market is, on the one hand, people are thinking about inflation, they're thinking about reflation, and they're thinking about growth. And there's still an incredible amount of enthusiasm for the decentralized finance markets and for Bitcoin more generally, and they're incredibly exciting, and where you can see prices moving by 10 and 20% in a day or even in a matter of hours, and where fortunes are being made and lost practically on a weekly basis, and where it's possible for enterprising artists to sell sculptures that are invisible. These are incredible activities. Some of the things that, and of course, we've also seen that when companies with no prospects and no business model and are only going up because people want to pressure the presumed shorts, and artists can sell things that are totally invisible, and we have a lot of retail activity in the market, well, that is representative of bubbly activity. And it's one of the things that people become really engaged about, and they start to think that we're on the cusp of a major decline. But I think it is worth reminding ourselves that, and then the question, of course, then I think starts to come through. How much of an influence can a bear market in cryptocurrencies have on the wider market? Because the one thing we know is that Bitcoin peaked in 2017, and the S&P 500 hit a meaningful peak about a month later. And that was potentially back then less related, but it was certainly a coincidence, or it was representative of a pullback in demand for everything, because at the moment there's an estimate, at least by Nasdaq, that 40 million Americans own Bitcoin. Well, with the price today, anyone who bought in 2021 is either sitting on a loss or is just about break even. So when we think about the outlook for consumer demand, well, the bear market in Bitcoin is something that could have a meaningful effect on demand for goods and services. I saw a real estate listing the other day where the seller was saying that they would accept Bitcoin for the house. So we can think about how people have been deploying the profits that they made from cryptocurrencies into other assets. So Bitcoin is pulling back right now, and then we have the Nasdaq popping up to a new all-time high yesterday and holding on to most of the gain in here today. At the other side, we have the Dow Jones, which has been pulling back and broke its sequence of higher reaction lows today. So then we can look at individual sectors, where the banking sector has been feeling the pressure from lowering of longer term yields. And then we have the energy sector, which is still holding on. And I didn't type in that correctly, but still holding the sequence of higher reaction lows, but looking a little tired in here. At the other end of the scale, where we have clear growth with business models that make sense, well, then you have continued strength. Google is one of those companies that's emblematic of the new economy. They've been deploying significant resources into research and development, and they estimate that they'll have a commercial quantum computer within the next 5 years. And they are very clear in stating that they have exponential growth in quantum computing. So that means that their efforts are multiplying to the power, or they're squaring rather than simply doubling. And I think that's the difference between going from 2, 4, 8. Instead, it would be going to 2, 4, 16, 64. So it doesn't take long to make massive strides when you're doubling, or you're multiplying at that kind of rate. And of course, they also have an additional business in advertising that is continuing to churn out significant cash flows. So the company is very cash heavy, and it continues to march higher. And Microsoft is also one of those companies with a strong business model. And then we have the additional point that these types of companies have adopted some variation on a subscription business model. And that means that they have succeeded in changing from being highly cyclical to being, are performing more like consumer discretionary. So Amazon has now bounced emphatically from the region of the trend mean over the last 2 weeks. And it was looking hairy as it tested that 3,000 area, and it has rebounded in very emphatic fashion. So we're right at the upper side of the range, and this is a new closing high for the week. So it's quite possible that with the compression in yields and with the potential that reflation is going to take longer and that growth may underperform in the wider economy, then the kinds of companies that benefited from the lockdowns and benefited from the pandemic generally and that have a record of delivering growth, then they get some additional favor from the market, which is why the NASDAQ is now outperforming. Well, then we can think about going back and looking at this yield curve spread. So if this is similar to what we had in the late 1990s, then the yield curve spread will trend down, and it would be representative of interest rates staying lower for longer, and the Federal Reserve might have spooked the market in here this week and contributed to some mean reversion, and certainly taken some of the wind out of the commodity complex, but that stocks will start to turn around, because if we get a slower recovery, it means then there will be more demand for fiscal spending, more demand for money supply growth. You had Mario Draghi in here today saying that Europe needs to go for more fiscal stimulus. And of course, he's now in charge of Italy, and Italy needs the stimulus. So that may be taken with a grain of salt, other than the fact that he's a former leader of the European Central Bank. If that is indeed the case, then it's quite possible that we move into the bubbly phase, and that this dominance of the retail hoard in relatively small companies expands, and that we go into a period where people don't pay much attention to prospects and start to think more about stories and narratives, and they really then start to really significantly lever other portions of the stock market. One thing that has perhaps held back that retail explosion in this cycle has been the cryptocurrencies, because there's about $2 trillion that was invested in cryptocurrencies and all manner of different tokens over the course of the last few years. And that money is now looking for a new home, and that new home could easily be in the stock market if the fear about imminent interest rate hikes is dissipating, or if more stay-at-home actions are deployed. So I really don't think that we're going to see more than a reversion back down towards the mean for stock markets, and that it's quite likely that we're going to see a further re-upping of interest in the technology sector overall. So then that's also positive for renewable energy. And if it's positive for renewable energy, it's positive for copper. And it's also positive for hydrogen, because the question for lots of people is that if we have this massive quantity of solar and wind on the system, then how do you produce base load? So there are lots of different evolving solutions out there. We have the continued drive by Fortescue Metals to develop green hydrogen. But right now, it's trading more like an iron ore company, so it's susceptible to some additional weakness. Obviously, the weakness we're seeing in copper has contributed to some profit-taking on BHP and the other main copper producers. So they are being set up for their next potential buying opportunity, but obviously copper and the industrial metals will have to steady first. As we look at the wider technology sector, I am reminded of the fact that the cure for high prices is high prices. And the SOX index has rebounded and tested the highs and was weaker in here today, down about 2%. And then we can think about some of the better performers like Nvidia, which had clearly broken on the upside, but it wasn't quite able to hold all of the advance in here today. So we're likely to get at least some pause and consolidation here. Then ASML, which I had written about yesterday, had a downside key reversal today. The one thing that's, I think, particularly relevant about this portion of the stock market is that it is still highly cyclical. There is nobody buying subscriptions to ASML's machines, and nobody's buying subscriptions to Nvidia's chips either. So that is something that is a clear delineation from the very large companies that do have subscription business models. What you get in the chip sector is very cyclical activity. So you get a jump in demand for chips, then you get a massive infrastructure boom that builds lots of new factories. All those chips come onto the market around the same time, and prices go down in a big way, and then it makes it more difficult for those less competitive portions of the market to survive, and the cycle begins again. We've had obviously a big surprise in this market, but the bigger question is how long is it going to take for some of these factories to be built and iron out the supply chain issues? When we think about, and I'm very conscious of the fact that I have not talked about the inflationary question, but the one thing I find particularly relevant is that the Baltic Dry Index is breaking out. So that adds an additional premium to all exported goods. And that is inflationary, and it's the kind of inflation that we will feel in our pockets. One thing that I find interesting as well is that the compression in inflation or components in the inflationary measures that we've seen over the last few decades, all the things that have compressed in price, like consumer electronics, are one-off items. You don't buy a new TV every week or every year. But the kinds of things that have contributed to inflation are sticky. So the education prices, health care prices, they've all been trending higher and trending higher in a dynamic manner. And those are sticky. Those are the kinds of things you pay for on a continuous basis. So that's been the background. And that's why you have this perception among lots of people that there must be inflation, because they see their costs rising all the time. But if we see the Baltic Dry Index breaking higher, and there is a bigger backlog right now of container ships in China than there was during when the Suez Canal was blocked off a few months ago, they're worried about the coronavirus and the outbreak of the Delta variant that's going on in Guangzhou and near Shenzhen. So they're also stopping some of their ports from exporting more, and this is contributing to shortages. Then you also have the imposition of the IMO 2020, and that was an additional factor that was going to contribute to higher levels for shipping in 2020, but it didn't happen because of the pandemic, but it's happening now. So that's an additional point. And then we have the kinds of sticky things that contribute to inflation, like wage growth, because you simply can't give people more money for doing nothing than they would for working and expect them to accept less for working in future. So wage demand growth is something that is going to become a political football, and That's going to happen within the next 6 months. And it's going to be particularly relevant as the moratoriums on evictions roll off and as the forbearance on the mortgage payments rolls off and as all of the additional stimulative measures that were introduced and provided to people who came on hard times roll off the books. That's going to have a significant impact on consumer demand. And when we take that in tandem with the compression in prices for cryptocurrencies, then it could contribute to a significant downward surprise in consumer demand growth in the second quarter and indeed in the third quarter. So as we think about what that means, we could have inflationary pressures dipping in the not so distant future, and not least because of the year over years, and then re-accelerating later. So it's, I think, likely that the Federal Reserve is going to have a bit of a surprise, and that they are probably less aware of just how much leverage there is in the system and how sensitive that leverage is to liquidity. So I think that inflationary pressures are rising and that there will be demand for hard assets. And the number one hard asset is gold. Gold is the anti-Bitcoin because gold is a bond with no debtor, and Bitcoin is the ultimate in long duration assets. So gold prices have pulled back in a violent manner this week, down for 6 consecutive days now, and falling from 1900 to 760, 1760 is a big move, and it is a larger weekly downward dynamic than we've seen during the bull at the decline from the peak in August. So we've had downward dynamics from the $1,900 area 3 times now, and on each of the previous occasions, it moved to a new low. So the bears are going to be thinking that the next time, or excuse me, on this occasion, now that it's failed at $1,900, it's going to pull back to $1,600. And that would be the consistent thing to happen if this is still a bear market. On the other hand, if this is now a recovery and the somewhat larger rebound from the most recent low is the beginning of a new bull trend, then gold will find support above the $1,700 area. Now, the one thing that I think is very relevant is that we had lots of evidence of exactly this kind of action in the bull market that peaked up to 2011. There were plenty of times where gold looked like it was going to recover and then had a very short, sharp pullback and then recovered quickly afterwards. So if this is one of those occasions, then it's likely we're going to see gold finding support sometime next week. I think it's likely. I think it's more likely than not that gold is in a support building phase right now. But obviously, a lot of investors are very positioned to be long the dollar. And this is a meaningful move off the lows. And if the dollar fails, then it will represent a significant tailwind for gold overall. If growth does moderate and the Federal Reserve is forced into backtracking, but I don't think that they're going to backtrack until we get about a 10% pullback on the S&P 500. And the market has a way of delivering those kinds of pullbacks in order to get the kind of action from central bankers that investors want. So we do have the potential for a taper tantrum in the stock market rather than the bond market on this occasion. the bond market is reacting to the potential that the Federal Reserve isn't going to abide by the trend towards modern monetary theory, and that they're not going to continue to print, and therefore the impetus to sell the bonds is much less convincing, and in fact they might even represent value. And if growth doesn't accelerate, then those bonds will represent value. So that's the rationale that's going on right now. So where does that leave the technology sector? Well, obviously we've had portions of the market do very well, and we've had, I think, clear evidence that some companies have carved out a niche that they can defend. So DocuSign is one of those, and it's the kind of company that came into its own during the pandemic, and it's likely to have a rosy future in front of it. And it's the kind of company that provides a service that makes people's lives easier. I became really impressed by PayPal over the course of the last few weeks. My daughter has been using it to take commissions from people all over the world, and she's getting paid via PayPal. She's also buying pieces of art from graphic designers all over the world using PayPal, and that's really one of the great strengths of the company. It's a truly international payments mechanism, so it is a portion of the fintech sector that's likely to continue to prosper. And then, of course, we have, you know, there's a lot of enthusiasm for the kinds of solutions that Square offers. And, of course, they have been active in supporting the cryptocurrency markets. So I find it rather interesting that despite the fact that crypto was down in a dynamic manner in here today and has broken lower, that Square has been able to find support in the region of its trend mean. So there's certainly pockets of the market that will continue to do well. And we can definitely think about the distributed or decentralized finance sector as being a very broad church. And there will be portions of the market that will succeed. But I've not been convinced yet as to why we actually need to have cryptocurrencies. The kinds of solutions that Alibaba and WeChat Pay, Tencent, were able to develop in China made ease of use the number one selling point, and they didn't have to resort to cryptocurrencies at all. One thing, though, that they were able to do was they circumvented the banking sector. And by circumventing the banking sector and being allowed to do that, then they were able to create these really impressive financial arms to their companies. So rather than it being a particular use case, the primary rationale for companies to adopt a crypto model is to avoid regulation from becoming banks. So that's the primary reason that Facebook has gone for the crypto rationale rather than just going to become an outright bank and deposit-taking institution, because they want to completely avoid the burden of regulatory oversight. So they think they can do that by adopting a crypto sector or a crypto model, because it's completely unregulated. Because what they want to do is to create a financial arm to their company in the same way that Alibaba and Tencent were able to do. But the big question then is whether that's going to be allowed by regulators in the West. So in many respects, the drive towards technological innovation has three primary struts to it. The first is innovation and new ideas and coming up with something that's never been done before. And the rapid innovation that we're getting from the quantum sector and from deep learning and the really incredibly impressive advance of artificial intelligence and how that is pioneering change in the healthcare sector and pioneering change in the defense sector. These are going to be significant game changers. And then the second strut for technology is regulation. So there is one model of technology that avoids regulation and then tries to do something new and get to a critical mass and win the popular vote before they're regulated. And there's of course two ways of doing that. You can either come up with something completely new that has never been done before and therefore there are no regulations exist, or you can break rules that are not enforced. And Uber did that, and they have been incredibly successful. And the company continues to hold around the region of the IPO price. We have Airbnb, and they also broke the short-term leasing rules in lots of different cities, and the share price is also modestly above its IPO price from the end of last year. So they were able to get to these extraordinary valuations, and the company now has a market cap of $95 billion, and investors in the IPO haven't done especially well. We have companies like Beyond Meat. They haven't broken any rules. They're the kinds of company that came out with a new product, and then they tried to really pioneer use of it. And the share has pretty much gone sideways for the last 3 years. You have companies that came up with new ways of doing things, like 3D printers, and they have broken out, and they've been able to now succeed because of their meme status. But the challenges about scaling up of additive manufacturing have not really been tackled yet. And the big bull markets that we're seeing and the things that are doing well are software related. So obviously software is easy to iterate on. And once you have marketing, each new customer does not require any incremental additional cost beyond the marketing cost of customer acquisition. So it's certainly in the software sector where we're seeing a lot of interest, and that is, I think, also helping to drive the performance of companies like PayPal and DocuSign and Google. And then you have companies like Thermo Fisher and Roper Technologies, where they own intellectual property, and they can do fantastically well because they have this portfolio of innovations that they protect and generate revenue from. So then when we think about the march of technology, it's about innovation, it's about regulation, but it's also about interest rates, because companies like Roper Technologies, they accelerated after 2008. If we think about the performance prior to that, it did well in the bull market up from 2003, and it was doing well before that in a jerky fashion. But the performance really took off in the period of quantitative easing. So the question that's practically impossible to answer is, how much do each one of those categories for technological success matter to the share price. Obviously, skirting regulations or performing in areas that are not regulated is inherent to a business model for upstart technology companies. The extent to which that they can come through with new ways of doing things that are cheaper or innovative or eke out a portion of a from a large competitor, that's part of their business model as well. But the other portion of their business model is sourcing funding. And that has been the primary beneficiary of these growth companies for most of the last decade. And the outlook for interest rates is the primary arbiter the longer this trend goes on. Because as valuations rise, then the sensitivity to interest rates goes up at an exponential rate. And if interest rates are coming, or if the yield curve spread is contracting, then that's generally positive for growth overall. And it means that central banks have got some faith that a recovery is in fact underway. And if that's the case, we might have ebb and flow, and we are certainly at risk right now of some pause of consolidation. And we're definitely seeing the potential for a reversion back down towards the mean in an increasingly large portion of the market. But if interest rates stay down and liquidity remains abundant, then the growth sector will continue to outperform and valuations will get even higher. And when we do start to see inflationary pressures become an issue, and it is likely that if we do see more money being printed, inflation will start to take off because central banks, they are terrified of seeing another recession, and governments are terrified of their populations. So deficit spending is likely to remain a significant issue, and it's likely to result in a lot of demand for new infrastructure. And infrastructure builds are being planned all over the world, and most of the world is running on deficits right now. And we have these difficult environments in places where they've been ravaged by the coronavirus. And the Brazilian real, for example, has strengthened significantly over the course of the last few months, and now it's encountering resistance around the five level. So there is the scope here that we get some correction in the performance of the emerging markets, and that short-term overbought conditions are unwound, and subsequently that we are set up for the next attractive buying opportunity. But certainly the risk of consolidation has risen, and there is, I think, the potential that what we're going to see is a rerun of the kind of speculative mania that occurred in the period up from 1998 to 2000. And if that's the case, well, then the smaller companies and the IPOs will continue to rebound. And it's particularly relevant that despite the weakness we've seen on other markets in here this week, that these very growth-oriented portions of the market have continued to do well. And I think with that, I will leave you for today and wish all the best to all of you.